Okay. So this was my cheesy visa commercial, of course. The answer for the last one is priceless. I was going to use a less controversial Peace on Earth and Goodwill to the Living, but then I was worried that I may have to put a huge disclaimer saying that it's kind of void where people may not want peace. So I decided not to be controversial in the last day. So the announcements are today. The take home will be released by Thursday, Friday. Check your mail and also the homepage. It would be set sort of like an in-class exam in the sense that you would have to answer all the questions in the space provided, but just that you'd get to do it at home. So in some sense, holiday cheer and milk of kindness and all that stuff. So it's really going to be an in-class exam that you wind up doing at home. So how much time you spend on it depends a lot on how much you already figured out versus how much time you're going to spend after you get the exam and start reading everything up freshly. Okay. I will hold office hours on Thursday. If there is a need for additional review session, either by me or by Will, let us know. Okay. Obviously, Thursday is the only day. Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday, I can't do anything. Thursday, I could do things. But then, whatever time I spend doing reviewing, I may not be able to set the exam, which actually could be good for you. After I give the exam, I would not answer clarification questions on the exam. I will answer clarification questions on the exam, but if you suddenly, after seeing, let's say, a perceptron question on the test, you suddenly realize that you always had been passionate about perceptrons, you just forgot to mention it to me earlier on, it makes no sense. You should decide what you're passionate about beforehand and ask me all those questions. But general clarification questions as to why does this question make sense are, of course, fine. I would have to look at the schedule, and I would let you know when I give the exam what is the date by which it is due. And that would be the date when you have to make sure that it's given in the, either you hand it to me or you give it to the department so that they'll put it in my mailbox. Okay. What else? There is an attendance sheet that went around. You should fill that. That's your participation feedback. How many of you have written that they have missed zero classes? Wow. Okay. I have candies for you. I was going to either give you candies or an upgrade, but I decided you would like candies more. Who are the ones who said this? Okay, candies for you. Who else? Please raise your hand when I come that side. Okay. You might want to frame this candy. Who else? You did?
Should we consider the optional class?
What? No, optional class, by the way, seriously, even if you did not attend the optional class, you still, optional class was optional because I kept it outside of the normal hours. Who else? I was going to give two candies per person, but apparently too many people attended all the classes. Anybody else who attended all the classes and didn't get a candy? Okay. So that's that, and then there is CES evaluations are going on. You can give your comments, I believe, until tomorrow midnight. and I sent you a mail. I think it's a good idea to do this. I won't get to see them until I give you the grades, and you'd have skipped the town. So you're okay with this. And then if you have any comments on the TA and the will that you want me to pass them on to them, you're welcome to send it to me anonymously or with your mail, and then I'll pass it on to them. Okay. That's basically it. And then today I'm going to actually do a couple of things. I believe we are already running behind schedule according to my tight schedule I put up here. One is I was just going to deal with a couple of loose ends. I was hoping by 2 p.m. I'll be done, more like 2:10 is when I'll be done. And then we'll have some fun trying to figure out what people got out of the course. And then we'll end. That's it. Okay. Before I start all this, are there any questions? There isn't approximately a week, because there is. If I give it on Friday, a Thursday, Friday, and you give it to me back on Friday, then registrar will be on my case. So it's more likely than not it's going to be due on Monday or Tuesday. That's the way it's going to be. Okay? Because it's not a week-long examination. Yes?
There's some issues with the project for grading. Some of us submitted it on Monday.
You should just talk to, I think there were too many complex arrangements that were made that you should just let the TA know, and I think that should be fine. Yes? What? The way it's going to be done, I have to look at my calendar, and I have to make sure that I have enough time to give you guys grades before I skip country. That has already been decided when I'm going to go away. And then registrar has also decided when he's going to come after me if I don't give the grades. So if there is any time, believe me, I don't gain anything by making deadlines hard and fast. I mean, whenever I find that I have time, I extend it. You know, if I do have time, I'll consider it. But, you know, expect it to be Monday, Tuesday, and they're always, normally the way I do is when I give the, I mean, keeping up with the chattiness of this course, when I give the take home, I also explain the rules under which people can ask for an extension. For example, if you have 5 exams between the time I gave you this test and the test is due, I don't know what this 5 or whatever number, then you get to ask me for a day extension. All I can't do is just blanket give people Wednesday, and then people will start asking me maybe Thursday, maybe Friday, and then I do not have the grades to actually provide. Okay, so that's the reality. If, you know, in situations where people have wall-to-wall exams, there probably are ways of going around. Okay, but that's what I've done on this. Other questions? Other questions? Okay. So I am just going to complete, like we sort of stopped in the mid-sentence last time. I was going to tell you why it makes sense to compute naive-based classifier by just simply taking, numerator by denominator ratios. Okay. And in what sense is that correct in any is it correct in any formal sense of the word? And to do that, we started talking about the notion of Bayesian learning, and we pointed out that as far as Bayesian learning is concerned, learning is not different from inference. You just keep track of all the hypotheses, okay? And you are essentially, as the data comes, the hypothesis, the unlikely hypothesis are becoming less and less likely, and the more likely hypothesis will dominate, but you never actually have picked any one of them as your hypothesis, okay? And you in essence are doing weighted classification. So if this is your hypothesis, what is the class, and what's the probability that this really is your hypothesis? And that keeps changing. The probability starts with the prior, you know, when you have seen 0 examples, the probabilities of the different hypotheses are their prior probabilities, which hypotheses are more likely than which, okay? And then you continue. Now, one interesting thing that you can see even in here is in most scenarios, as the number of examples increase, okay, prior does not have as much of an effect. Okay, so if you have very few examples, then it's important to know what is the true prior distribution on the hypothesis. But if you don't, as you get more and more examples, the examples tell their own story. And so you can forget about what is the prior on the hypothesis. So it's very important to know the prior if you have very few examples. And we'll mention this maybe a couple of times more today. So we talked about how to use this, and then we also said this makes no Bayesian learning, an optimal Bayesian learning cannot make sense. Optimal Bayes learning is optimal in the sense that you cannot do any better, okay, in classification accuracy than a Bayesian learner. But you do not really get to do Bayesian learning because in most reasonable scenarios, there are way too many hypotheses. And you cannot keep track of the distribution over all those hypotheses without making up your mind as to which one you're really committing to. And so what you wind up doing is rather than consider the weighted summation of all the hypotheses, you essentially you pick the best hypothesis, one best hypothesis based on the examples right now, and then just use that as the basis for classification. So in the previous example, for example, I could just, if I know this scar, of course, I can just look at this hypothesis right here. That would be the best hypothesis because it has the highest probability. And you just stick to it and then use that to classify. Okay, now one of the interesting things is if you stuck to this hypothesis and classified after having seen 10 examples, your accuracy is going to be just as good as looking at all the hypothesis because the rest of the hypotheses have actually fallen down in accuracy. But somewhere around here, it's much less obvious which one to pick. And in fact, remember that having seen exactly one example, you would have picked the blue one as the most likely hypothesis. Because according to the examples, that was the most likely hypothesis. Okay, even though in fact this is the one that is the right one, you know, given the full distribution. Okay. Having said that, you do pick, so the way you compute the best hypothesis essentially is you're taking the hypothesis that maximizes this expression. Because after all, that was the expression over which you were summing. That was the expression over which you are summing here. Okay? Now, if you're maximizing over this, then you are essentially maximizing this expression is essentially the same as maximizing this expression, which is logarithmic. And since logarithms are monotonic, then if you maximize the log, then you have maximized the original function. So they both reach the maximum at the same point. Okay. So you're finding the hypothesis which maximizes this expression among all the hypotheses. Now, if you look at this, it has two pieces. One is log of the probability that the data will actually be present given this hypothesis. This is called the likelihood. So the data would actually be generated if this was the hypothesis. And then this one is the log of the probability of the hypothesis itself. Okay, if the probability of the hypothesis is very high, log of the probability of the hypothesis would be very low. Right, log of, so basically this is the negative. You notice that you can think of this and this are similar to your information content heuristics, the entropy heuristics that we used in the decision trees. Okay, so you can think of these as the negative of the information content of the hypothesis itself and the data given the hypothesis. If you believe this hypothesis, how surprised are you by this data? That's what this log is telling you. Okay? So in fact, there are nice ways to interpret this expression, maximization of this expression. In some sense, you're thinking of the simplest hypothesis that explains the data the best. The simplest hypothesis that explains the data the best. Okay? And the word simple comes because you can think of log of probability of hypothesis itself as how many bits do you need to represent this hypothesis. Okay? And this is called map approximation or maximum a posteriori. So having seen the data, which is the hypothesis that is maximally likely? And then you're picking that. Okay? Now, sometimes you'll also notice that if the number of hypotheses keeps, number of data points keeps increasing, this, if the data is identical and independently distributed, okay, then this is probability that the D1 given HI times probability that D2 given HI times probability that D3 given HI and so on. And the log of that whole thing is the summation over all these data points. So as the data increases, you have to realize that this expression is going to dominate over this expression eventually. You see that? Okay, as the number of data points increase, ultimately this expression is going to dominate over this expression, which is essentially what you have seen, irrespective of what the exact prior is. If these were the samples, if the samples that you got in the cherry scenario is lime, 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 then it doesn't really matter what was your prior hypothesis space. You'll ultimately realize that the bag you're bringing the candies from is most likely to be all cherry bag, I mean all lime bag. Okay? So if you want to ignore that, then you would be doing a slightly different maximization problem where you just have to maximize this. You don't even work on this. Okay? The advantage of that is you then don't need to know any prior information about how hypotheses are distributed. Either ignoring log of PHI or assuming that all hypotheses are equally likely, which would give the same exact delta to everybody, okay, would essentially make this expression become a maximum likelihood approximation where you ignore the prior. Ignore the prior. Okay? And so, and in fact, in many senses, it's easier to optimize because you only have one thing, a log of something, and you're trying to find the optimum. And you take the derivative equal to zero and find out where the derivative becomes equal to zero, and those would be your maximum points. Okay? And another interesting point is that actually maximum likelihood approximation is like two steps away from optimum Bayes prediction. Optimum Bayes prediction doesn't even make up its mind. It says all hypotheses I'll keep around. Maximum a posteriori keeps only one hypothesis around, but it picks it using both the data and the prior information. And because it uses prior information, it's actually map works very well when you have very few examples. And if you remember, I sent you an example on this Economist, mail on the Economist article on Josh Tenenbaum's research, which basically says humans are able to very quickly come to right hypothesis, right prediction, even given when shown very few examples. And oftentimes they were able to explain this based on the fact that humans seem to have certain strong priors associated with certain types of data. Okay? But then if you have tons and tons of data, you don't need priors. Okay? Maximum likelihood is actually the one that became very popular in statistical learning community for the longest time for a slightly different reason. One reason, of course, is, you know, if you do just maximum likelihood, you don't need prior information. The other is statisticians as a whole tend to take the view that there is no reality in the world other than the data. Okay? So you should not have any additional extra information about your problem. Data should be the only thing that you look at. And in fact, much of what is happening in machine learning can be understood in terms of this competing pull from statistics, which says try not to have any prior because data should describe itself. Okay? And you know, cognitive science and AI, which says we are not born with empty brains. We have strong biases, we have strong priors, and we need to figure those out. Okay? And so pendulum in machine learning swings sort of between the statistics influence and cognitive science AI influence. Both are very important, but you see where the different kinds of influences come from. Okay. So statisticians essentially feel much happier with maximum likelihood approximation because they are not making any assumptions about this. They'll say, where did you get this? This I can understand, it's coming from the data. Where did you get this? And you would say, that's background knowledge, and they'll say, no, we don't like background knowledge. Okay? And in fact, they are right. If you have tons and tons of samples, then prior just the importance of prior, the influence of prior just vanishes. Again, remember, when in doubt, remember this picture. When you are here, the prior with which you started makes a difference. By the time you come here, the data essentially is telling you what is the right hypothesis, irrespective of where you started from. Okay? And it's the only thing that's needed for the data to show its true form is that the prior did not remove a hypothesis by giving it a zero probability. As long as every possible hypothesis that can be the true hypothesis is given non-zero probability, sooner or later the data will show, will make the right hypothesis stand up. Okay? But if you have much less data, and in fact that's becoming more and more the case in several scenarios, and in fact human learning oftentimes happens from few examples. Right? You didn't get, I mean, despite what you thought yesterday night, you really didn't get as many homework problems as you would need to learn without any background knowledge, just from that homework problem. So we learned from fewer examples, and so it's sort of important to know about map approximation, even though much of statistical learning is ML approximation, which is maximum likelihood approximation. Having said that, the last thing I want to say is if you were trying to do maximum likelihood approximation and you're trying to compute the parameters, then essentially it would involve taking the derivative of a logarithm and equating it to zero. Okay, so for example, in our cherry example, suppose you assume that the probability, so theta is the parameter that tells you the probability that a random candy you pick is going to be cherry flavored. Remember, it could be the cherry flavored or lime flavored. So it's really a binomial distribution here. So cherry is the theta, so 1 minus theta probability would be the lime flavor. Okay? So you can assume that the entire space of hypothesis for this cherry and lime candy problem can be represented in terms of this space of hypothesis. Theta power, you know, theta, can be represented in terms of the binomial distribution with parameter theta. Okay? Now, if it turns out that, so, and without making up your mind as to what the parameter theta is, you're going to define the theta from the example. Okay? Now, suppose you have seen n candies till now, and c of them are cherries, and n minus c are limes, then the probability of the data given the hypothesis would be theta power c and 1 minus theta power l. This is just tosses. Think of this as heads and tails. So you don't know what theta is, but whatever the theta is, to see n cherries, n candies of which c are cherries and n minus c are limes, it would be theta power c and 1 minus theta power l, where l plus c equal to n. Okay? Now what I need to do is I want to maximize this probability and see where it becomes maximum, with respect to which theta it becomes maximum. So to do this, I'll first take a logarithm of this, because logarithms for maximum is the same as the normal, the original function maximum. And if I do the logarithm maximum, then I'll get this nice expression, t log theta plus plus l log 1 minus theta. Okay? Now, if you, you know, differentiate it with respect to theta, and if you remember from your old days that the derivative of log is log of x is 1 by x, okay? So then you get here c by theta, and you'll get here minus l by 1 minus theta, and that minus comes because theta has a minus here. This is just your differentiation from your old days, okay? So all I'm saying is C by theta minus L by 1 minus theta must be equal to 0. And use some little elementary algebra, you'll get theta equal to C by N. What it's saying is, if you have seen N candies and C of them are cherries, then the hypothesis that maximizes the probability of finding this is that theta, the parameter theta, happens to be C by N. Now this is exactly what you would have done if I didn't show you logarithms. I mean, you'd have said, yeah, I mean, I saw N candies, C of them are cherries, so I just assume that, you know, C over N is the fraction of cherries. But this gives you a nice theoretical basis to what you're doing. Essentially, you are indeed optimizing. You are indeed finding a maximum over the space of hypothesis. Okay? Think of this as, you know, once you figure this out, then you don't need to do this. For naive Bayes, we were actually computing these numbers all the time for the priors and for the conditionals. In fact, you can extend this for conditionals too. You can extend this for conditionals, and when you have conditionals, then you can take, you have multiple parameters. So this looks much more like an NBC. There is a prior here, and there is a conditional probability table here. And you can compute the probability of the data given all these hypothesis parameterized in terms of this theta, theta 1, theta 2. That'll be a bigger expression in terms of theta, theta 1, theta 2. And you can take partial derivatives, equate them to zero. And that's essentially what NBC is doing. You're just skipping this middle step. Okay? One last thing, I guess this is. Yeah, that's it. We said that naive Bayes classifiers really are making huge assumptions. They're assuming that the class generates each of the features. So the only structure in the domain is class variable causes each of the features. So we don't consider the possibility of correlations between the features. We don't consider the possibility that there are hierarchical structure among the features and so on and so forth. In most scenarios, you can't assume that the features are completely independent. It makes life simple to learn NBC classifiers, but because there are very few, I mean, given the data, there's only a single naive Bayes network. There are potentially a large number of Bayesian networks. Okay, it makes your life simple. But why should making your life simple ever have any connection to the reality of the world? Why should it be that naive Bayes classifier works at all? Of course, I don't know whether I told you enough or not, but naive Bayes classifiers work extremely well, surprisingly well, in many, many cases. It almost makes you wonder, is it really worth going through an entire course only to find that one of the better working algorithms involves taking ratios? Okay? Naive Bayes algorithm actually works very well, and one time actually Peter Norvig, who is the at that time, director of search quality at Google, was asked. So he used to be actually director of the machine learning group there. So they asked him, so what machine learning techniques do you use? He said, naive Bayes classifier. You know, it's sort of like, you know, you ask a full professor, what math do you use? Addition. You know, it looks sad. And so why is it that Google gets by with naive Bayes classification? It's surprising. Okay? And the interesting thing is, indeed, we know that features are not independent. And yet, NBC winds up working. Even in scenarios where features are not independent, naive Bayes classifier seems to work well. And to understand this, you have to understand this part. Naive Bayes classification, really, you remember that this was a Bayes network. And a Bayes network originally was meant to capture the joint probability distribution over some n variables. In this particular case, you are writing this naive Bayes network as the best representation of the correct joint probability distribution over the variables f1 to fn plus class. And in actually representing the joint distribution, naive Bayes classifier is often a measurable failure. its error from the true probabilities are way high compared to the true joint distribution. Okay? You cannot actually use it to exactly compute what is the true probability that class is true given F2 is true, F3 is false, etc. But you don't need true probabilities to do classification. All you need is which is bigger than which. So imagine that given, you know, F1 true and F4 false, in according to the real joint distribution, the probability that class is true is 0.789 and that it is false is 1 minus 0.789. That's the true probability. NBC might actually say it's 0.51, 0.49. The probability numbers are wildly off, but the answer is the same. You give the same answer if you had the true joint distribution as you did, because in both cases you will look at which is the higher probability and pick that. Okay? And in fact, there's a nice paper by Domingo some years back which actually analyzes this and points out that the reason naive Bayes classifier works as well as it does is because you're not interested in the true density. You're not interested in the true probability distribution. In places where the true probability distribution is important, naive Bayes networks are useless. But in places where all you need to do is classify, it's good enough. Okay? So again, it's like the elections. I mean, if the true popularity of candidate 1 is this, and the true popularity of the candidate 2 is this, and the election gives the popularity of candidate 1 to be this, and the candidate 2 to be this, in a winner-take-all election, there is no difference. In a French kind of democracy, there is a huge difference, because in France, they are into decimal numbers, and they actually say, if you got 76% of the popular vote, you get 76% of the house seats. Okay? And we don't like French fries and all that stuff, so I'm not supposed to even talk about this. But there are elections in the world where, in fact, the result of the election is not winner-take-all. But many, many elections are winner-take-all. And classification, indeed, is winner-take-all. That actually makes a difference. Okay? So that's where I'm going to end technical discussion of machine learning. And I'm going to say a couple of things about what we did, not too much. This is the list of topics that we have covered, I believe. I just copied them from the class list, class notes list. And a different way of looking at it is these are the chapters from the book, and I sort of put in green the chapters that I believe we covered more than 50%, you know, maybe fully 100% or maybe 60%, okay? And I put in red chapters that we more or less didn't touch. It's like less than 10%, less than 5%, other than by passing. Okay? And I put in this whatever this color, brown, chapters that we talked about somewhere less than 50% but more than 10%. So we have did talk about some pieces of it. Okay? So this also gives you, to the extent that the Russell and Norvig textbook gives you the AI universe, so you sort of know which parts we didn't do and which parts we did do. Okay? I think the biggest mass of red is here, which is communicating, perceiving, and acting. Part of the reason is that the background that is needed to do this well tends to be much more engineering, signal processing oriented. And to some extent, if you want to do full AI, you need that background as well as your discrete math background. Okay. But nevertheless, the fact that we didn't do it doesn't mean that they're not important. It's just, you know, I had to pick something. One thing that I used to do in the class all the time, and I didn't do this time, is constraint satisfaction, which actually I gave that up so that we could do a lot more probabilistic reasoning. In this time, we did a lot more reasoning with uncertainty, temporal-based networks, statistical learning-based networks, and so on. In the past, I used to do just maybe a third of what we did. on that. Okay, but so something had to go, and this poor guy went. This is very important too. I did mention constraint satisfaction problems and satisfiability technology when I told you this story about how to compute the number of models by asking people in a stadium to raise their hands while tossing the coins at the same time. Okay, it's a great technology. In fact, it is going to be the driving force for many of the working algorithms. And it's just that, you know, we didn't get to do that. Another place where constraint satisfaction was discussed is propositional satisfiability. Propositional satisfiability is also constraint satisfaction. Okay. So that's basically, I believe, what we did. So I was told once that it doesn't matter what you cover, it matters what you uncover. And I have my usual set of jokes here. This is all these Farsight cartoons, which basically, I like this one where this guy is talking to Ginger, the dog or the pig, I can't tell. You know, full, completely, grammatically formed sentences. And the Ginger is hearing this, blah, 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 Ginger, blah, 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 Ginger. And I always looked at this and I always wondered who is the sillier living thing there, the pig or the human, you know. So my thing is, what matters is what the pig understood. And if this guy doesn't understand what pig can or cannot understand, then the system fails as a whole, but it's also not clear whether it's the pig or the guy who should be laughed at. Having said that, I want to find out if there's a good way of saying pig, right? What the other living things, the less stupid things in this class, understood, actually. So we will do interactive semester review now. I did notice that this is a scan of all the people looking at the acquired wisdom from fall 2003. So it looks as if people are going to just say, yeah, I am Will Cushing's opinion. I am this other guy's opinion. And which also, I hope that's not what we're going to do. I hope you have your own opinions and you're going to voice them. And also, even if you did have somebody else's opinion, voice them in your voice. And let me tell you my last joke before we start doing this, which is, did I tell you the meta joke jokes? So there is this club where this guy goes to with his friend, and this club is essentially they meet and they exchange jokes. And so this is the club he goes to, and then he finds that somebody stands up and says 79, and everybody starts laughing. And then what? Then somebody else stands up and says 395, and everybody is laughing. So he goes and asks his friend, so what's going on? Why are these people laughing? He says, no, we have been meeting so long, we know all the jokes. So we catalog them, we put them in a big book, we numbered them. So instead of wasting time, we just say the number. And everybody knows what joke we are talking about, they laugh. So the new guy runs to the book, goes, finds out a joke that he really thinks is funny, comes back and says 197. Stone silence, nobody is laughing. And so he looks at his friend and says, how could this happen? I mean, that was a really nice joke. 197 is a really nice joke. How come nobody is laughing? He says, well, it's in the way you tell the joke. Okay. So it's not just I know you're also going to say, some of you are going to say, I like the decision trees, I like the neural networks, I like planning. Maybe I hope somebody will say I like planning. But it's the way you say it that matters. You know, it's true that everybody has understood everything before you, but what we would like to know is what you understood. And we have all of some number of minutes. And I have this thing that I can pass on to whoever is talking. And who wants to go first? Talk about, take maybe a minute and talk about the topics that you thought made most sense to you. And if you also want to talk about the topics that we wasted too much time on, feel free to say that, okay? And avoid saying, I mean, you don't need to talk about the quality of the instruction or the quality of the course. You have more than enough bytes that CES provides, okay? So don't worry about doing that. Talk about just the topic. Who wants to do it? You, okay, Steve Holler. And I have Lei Tang writing this all down, apparently. Okay. go ahead. Just start. That's all. Yes. Earlier stuff. Well, after that, you're too busy actually doing the project to actually pay attention. Okay. Vacuum cleaner agent. Okay. Good.
Okay. Should I say what I just wanted to?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Just mostly the later stuff. Yeah.
That's good.
It's just, I think I have the first order stuff, especially with the questioning you're giving. It's not particularly you, but seems like you want us to get in the mood of writing sentences, asking these questions, because if you're trying to solve a logic, it won't work out unless you ask the right questions.
Yeah, that's true in English too.
Yeah,
it turns out if you don't ask the right question, people won't give you answers.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent, logic is a language, so you need to learn.
Yeah, I feel like I'm learning like not the program, but actual language.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I know that sounded more like a bug for you, but it's actually a feature, in the sense you need to learn how to write what you want to say in logic. Yes. Yes. Who wants to go next? Wow, there are actual people. Okay. Yes, sir. Go over with this man.
A lot of the stuff that we covered in that session sort of you can apply to a lot of projects and stuff, not just things you can do with the AI, and also the problem of super manage or understand the way the networks work and how things figure out a lot of stuff just to the right process.
Okay. By the way, just a syntactic thing, talk to the class, not to me, okay, because don't feel like you have to talk to me. In general, you're just making a statement about what made sense to you, and I think, you know, that's interesting in itself. By the way, I do want to mention that there are big goals for AI, but even if we, in your lifetime, not essentially figure out the complete nature of intelligence and duplicate it in a computer, we'll have, you know, a lot of intermediate things that we could do as we develop the technology. And similarly, so the kinds of search technology, the kind of SAT technology that has been developed has been used in all sorts of other places, the same with search and same with probabilistic reasoning. But it's not just what you're doing, but why you are doing it. You know, I think that's part of the issue in AI. So that part of the reason you might be doing it could be because you think this is the way to design an agent that would be able to do intelligent behavior. Okay? Yes?
Hi, I'm Kyle. Probably my favorite part of the course was doing adversarial search and the pruning of the computer process. I like the time to programming and all that stuff, and also this seemed like a direct correlation between what we're doing in class and like the food programming. Actually,
Good. Again, who's going to ask? Vendor, fine. There is one thing that I just wanted to mention, which is with respect to what Kyle said. Adversarial search, every semester I go through some process of deciding whether to talk about it or not. Like when Juan Lu does it, for example, he doesn't teach adversarial search. Part of it is because there's no follow-up on adversarial search in the rest of the course. But I thought the way we went from A-star search and MDPs and into that, from there to adversarial search, made me happy enough that I included it. And I do it really for that reason, because many people heard about Deep Blue, and it would be interesting to find out what it does. And furthermore, one of the things that we haven't done enough in the class, and it would be very important, as why do you need communication? Why do we need to speak? If I'm alone, I don't need to speak to myself. If I do, people will throw stones at me, right? I mean, why is he talking to himself? We need communication because we have other agents. Multiple agents is very important. It's just that the fact that we didn't do enough of it here doesn't mean that it's not important. And there's a lot of work, very interesting work that's going on right now, is about multiple agents and coordinating them, communication between them, and so on and so forth. So think of adversarial search as the briefest glimpse into that world. And, you know, and there is a lot out there. Yes, sir. You did or you didn't?
Well, I'm sorry.
You did not enjoy it.
Well, when I got it, it was nice.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. Yes, Brandon.
So, I really enjoyed the
Uh-huh, okay.
Last night or whenever I did it. So, and lastly, I also really enjoyed getting intimately interested in your family on Project 4.
My family. You don't know whether those are the right names or not, but so. But on the other hand, let me tell you the following thing. I know I already said the last joke, but this is the last anecdote. Srinivas Ramanujan is a great mathematician. You should read about him if you don't already know. He's like a world-class mathematician who basically lived in Madras in 30s, 20s, and he wrote a letter to Professor Thomas Hardy, essentially giving him a huge number of results on partition functions and so on, and saying, could a, you know, would he be interested in working with him? And, you know, professors these days get way too many mails, and even those days they used to get mails from cranks. And Thomas Hardy is at the height of his career. And he had to decide, and Thomas Hardy was the fourth guy he sent this letter to. The first three guys said, who would talk to some crank from some random place, you know, making up these formulas? And Thomas Hardy actually worked with him, not G.W. Hardy, why am I saying Thomas Hardy? G.W. Hardy worked with him, and he later on, made this claim that while they could not verify whether these formulas for partition functions made by Ramanujan were actually right or wrong, he felt if they had to be right, because if they are not, nobody would have the imagination to make them up. So similarly, if my family names must be right, because I don't think you could have made them up. You know, you need a lot more imagination. Who else wanted the mic? Yes.
Mm-hmm. from a different set that is fire. It's very interesting to me.
Okay.
Second point is actually for my undergraduate students, I have learned something about AI. Also, nearly all the algorithm cover in class, but this time, I remember first class you mentioned the chapter 2 is really important. To see the different algorithms from the agent for that. That means such as from storage agent or utility-based agent, how to organize these different sections into a whole system. Such as I remember the rectangle, which one, what will I do, what are the actions of my results, that kind of thing. Help me to reorganize the knowledge I have learned before.
I may have mentioned in the beginning of the class when I started talking about intelligent agent design that Russell has these black boxes, that this is the set of lectures that some people love, I guess you are one of them, and some people hate, and they feel that was a waste of time. You know, why do we need an organizer? It's a question of, do you need a rational way of organizing a bunch of topics that you're reading about? And it's not necessarily the case that Russell got those black boxes right, okay? But until then, until I started looking at those things, I would always hate starting the second class of AI. The first class of AI is easy to start. You know, it's like everybody's interested. The second class of AI, before you start talking about A-star search, what exactly do you say other than you'll do a bunch of things for the rest of the semester, which just, you know, is very hard to get excited about. And so if nothing else, this will help you, this intelligent agent, the agent design architectures would help you in organizing where should which different pieces fit. And just as the organizer that you have for putting your records is no better or worse than the organizers that I have for putting in my CDs, it's just an organizer. Okay, so even if it only uses that, it still has helped you because you know in what, why are we interested in search? Why are we interested in reasoning? Why should we care about dynamic based networks in terms of the big picture, okay? So that's sort of a reasonable organization. Well, yes, Song Meng. By the way, you should say your names, I guess. Not enough names are known to Lee. yeah, that's Yun Song Meng. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, in terms of your first category, I love it, I love it.
Okay.
It's a bunch of them. And in the midterm, you mentioned some other universe that I checked that.
What I didn't get last part?
In the midterm.
In the midterm.
The sample midterm, you mentioned some other universe.
Tarskian interpretations, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
I also checked that.
Okay. I mean, these are giants. I mean, the names, Herbrand, Tarski, Kurt Gödel, these are all giants of mathematics and mathematical logic. You know, it's just we wind up having to deal with them, you know, because they talked about semantics for logic. And as I said, one interesting thing about first-order logic, however, currently what happened, one thing that I didn't spend that much time on in this class is, well, we didn't do really, is there was no first-order probabilistic logic that we talked about. Okay, to the extent you like first-order logic, and Steve Haller exception, you know, you need first-order logic. The world is made up of objects and relations between them, and you need to be able to talk about it that way. Uncertainty is important, so is object structure. And so, as I said, first-order probabilistic logic, that's one of the most feverishly worked on areas right now. And you know, figuring out inferences, semantics, and inferences for inference methods for that is going to be important. You know, maybe 6-7 years from now, maybe I'll be able to teach that in the intro to AI if I can still talk. But that's one of the areas. And you know, I think logic is not deterministic logic by itself is not useful. But it's also the case that propositional probabilistic logic is not by itself completely useful. You know, it does slightly more than pure deterministic proposition logic. Yes.
Also, love the language you choose for project list, and kind of useful. when you want to learn something about the language, the programming language, the Lambda correction.
So Google has a cluster of machines. I'm sure all of you are trying to interview at Google. Google has a huge cluster of machines on which they have to do various kinds of simple operations on a huge number of machines. And the higher level architectural paradigm they came up with, you know, language paradigm they came up with to work with this cluster of machines is basically MapCar Reduce. Okay? And you can read about it. That's essentially what they do. So you may or may not, you know, and what somebody said is an idea, once you're exposed to an idea, your brain is not going to get back to its old place. So all I hope is one day in the bowels of C++ hacking, you'll say, oh my God, this, I wish I had this other thing I was able to do. And from discontent comes change. You know, I mean, you were discontent during using Lisp too, but, you know, hopefully you'll be also discontent because of Lisp with C++. So there's more to life than C++. Okay.
It's actually the extra point about the notation failure. I understand how it is. It's in payment that, but the idea is, and the how to method behind that is
much harder. Actually, that's a very good point. I mean, the negation as failure is very easy to implement, but providing reasonable semantics for negation as failure, you know, tricked a lot of people for a while. I mean, it's now understood, but it's not as easy, because that's the way you get into non-monotonic reasoning. Yes. Who else has things to say? Yes. Yeah, that's the Tenenbaum paper which was talking about the possibility that we might have priors embedded in our reasoning. Again, it's very hard to lobotomize people and tell whether or not they have lambdas in their brain, but, you know, there are ways in which they try to set up experiments. Others, notice I'm not really forcing, even though I made a dark statement, but I hope you have something to say. Yes. Give me that. I'll take it. Yeah. I'll come back here. Yep. Well, yeah, there's... Philippe Lopez. By the way, there is a National Lampoon, if you go to National Lampoon's website, they have a hilarious spoof on the most recent Kramer episode, the real life Kramer episode, which they connect up to the rest of Seinfeld. Amazing. Yeah. Did you want to talk? Right? Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
It's one thing to read about time reflecting in a book, but another thing to go to bed and wake up and have your program still running. Before this class, if my program did compile and run, get an answer.
So, you go ahead.
You know, like you said, I don't know if it's motivating to change my programming style, but at least now I feel bad about it.
So I as half of my life I do research these days in databases, data integration, and I started reading database papers. My first reaction was, this was 12-page long footnote-sized paper, footnote-sized font paper, which is talking about what would be a footnote in a AAAI paper. Okay, then essentially what happens in AI is oftentimes because most things are at least NP complete and otherwise you won't pay attention to them, you know, really all most reasonable problems you are looking for are intractable. Okay, so whereas most of your other areas, if you show intractability, then you do something else. And you know, in AI we things start getting interesting when it's NP complete. And then the rest of the hierarchy is ours to play with. And as we say, we have semi-decidability just at first order logic, you know, in terms of theorem proving. Yes?
So I think the interesting part of the lecture was the one that high level visualization. For example, lecture on RPG, where it generates an MVP, and if you take a deterministic way using the F value at the least, it turns out to be an RTA star.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take min-max strategy, it becomes a game thing. And some another such collector is the visualization using the Russell's example on the biases, where you could have used the NBC or association of machine learning. These part of the lectures are interesting. One more thing I noted was the concern on memory we are using throughout the course.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, previously the memory, nowadays the memory is getting more and more cheaper, and the techniques like pattern databases are becoming popular. So I wonder how such techniques could be applied to other places. It's like there might be a scenario in future where you almost pre-compute all the possible views and store it in a database. Let's make it question.
So that is actually a very good point, and people, especially in search, worry about it. But thankfully, even 24 puzzle, you can't do this. And 24 puzzle is as dull as a doorknob, and yet you cannot really pre-compute and store everything. And so we are talking humongous search spaces. However, the falling prices of memory are going to change what kinds of algorithms are important and what kinds of algorithms are less important. Since we are coming up on 55, I'll do one more, and then I will have a slide, and then we end. All of you would be asked one pre-question, since you stayed all the way here. One pre-question in the final would be, list five ideas that you liked, and list five ideas that you felt, you know, are overplayed. And so you all get to, if you thought about this, you can write them down, and then you're going to get 5 points on the final. So I will hear about your voices too in that way. Who wants to have the last word? I think not enough women spoke, so you should.
And what I'm asking about is the fact that I actually have a
I have two comments. Comment one is throughout the semester, once in a while, somebody would say we might be doing too much for a 4-7 undergraduate course. I invite you to look at Stuart Russell's Intro to AI course that he teaches to Berkeley undergrads. I know I'm as good as Stuart Russell. I hope you are as good as Berkeley undergrads. Okay. This is my normal last slide. Those of you who saw Schindler's List can imagine the music behind. Basically, the list of topics that I would have covered if I had time. Okay. Like I mentioned, CSP and SAT technology is one of the things that I would have liked to spend more time on. I did that in the past, and I think it's a great idea there. Reinforcement learning, I made the slides, but we don't have time. I think it's a great idea. We should have talked about it. Bagging and boosting is a way, if you are given any single learner which has 0.5 plus epsilon accuracy, 0.5 plus epsilon accuracy, you can then stack it up on itself and reach any level of accuracy. And there are very powerful ideas, and it's really nice to talk about them. Planning under uncertainty and incompleteness, it's connected to dynamic Bayes networks. It would have been great to do more of that. Multi-agent anything. We only did the adversarial reasoning with respect to multi-agent reasoning. That would have been more to do. Perception, of course, you know, it would be great to at least start talking about statistical language processing. Some of that you can hear it in information retrieval sorts of courses. And then, you know, of course, be less demanding more often. It's been great teaching you guys. Have fun for the next couple of days before the final comes. Bye.